Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. And we're going to be talking with Steve Grace about tufted puffins. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, I'm sure that sound is familiar to many, so this week's mystery sound should be quite easy. Just a few days ago, while sitting on a log at the North Beach County Park and gazing out at the water, I enjoyed watching barn swallows dart through the air catching insects. Did you know that barn swallows can consume over 60 insects per hour? That's at least one a minute. And barn swallows, by the way, can be distinguished by their very long, deeply forked tails and their pale orange underparts. So Nora Petricks is going to help share an observation. So Nora.
Any time of the year can be a good day for walking and bird watching at Cotai Lagoon. And recently, a group from the Admiralty Audubon Society enjoyed an evening walk during which they spotted and heard a total of 22 species, including cedar waxwings, hooded mergansers, Virginia rails, northern shovelers, American widgeons, and pied-billed grebes.
And at our last low tide exploration at Salt Creek County Park, west of Port Angeles, Wendy Feltham and I spotted a large, very large, healthy, very healthy, mottled sea star. And it was such a relief to see these creatures slowly rebounding from the devastations of the sea star wasting disease outbreak a few years ago. Other highlights included orange cup corals, long-stalked tunicates or sea squirts, and a white and orange-tipped nudibranch. In addition to the ever-present tide pool sculpins, we spotted green pinpoint gunnel, northern clingfish, and a curious, very curious-looking high coxcomb. Nearly every Saturday evening from July through mid-August, the Puget Sound Express partnered with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center to offer three-hour cruises to look for tufted puffins and other seabirds and mammals of the Salish Sea. Equipped with cameras from point-and-shoot types to long-lens telephoto cameras and binoculars, we set off from the dock at Point Hudson about 6 p.m. Captain Chris Hankey, as grandson of the Puget Sound Express founder, Pete Hankey Sr., knew that tufted puffins had been regularly observed on the bluffs of Smith Island. A quick poll of passengers decided that the possibility of puffin sightings outweighed our original planned destination of Protection Island. So off we went to Smith Island. Smith Island and nearby Minor Island are about midway between Admiralty Inlet and Lopez Island, and they're about 5.5 miles west of Whidbey. So let's go to my conversation with Steve Grace. So we're back with Steve Grace. We talked together, a few weeks ago, and about a tour that Steve and I had been on, Steve as a naturalist, I was as a host for the Marine Science Center, aboard the Glacier Spirit. But we wanted to talk more about the tufted puffins and what we saw that Saturday evening. If you want to listen to the first part of the show, which I certainly encourage you to do, please go to the KPTZ website and listen to the podcast. So, Steve, it's great to be talking more about tufted puffins.
Hey, Nan, it's great to be back with you.
So, on the cruise, you were chatting about the various collective nouns for groups of birds. Of course, one of my favorites, of course, is that a group of crows is a murder of crows. Steve's now showing me his T-shirt, which is a bunch of crows with murder underneath it.
I dressed for the occasion.
Right. Well, actually, share some names of non-puffin.
Oh, I'm so
first.
Glad. Yes, this is one of my favorite things in the world. Okay, so yeah, so a lot of people know murder of crows, gaggle of geese. Those are kind of some of the more common ones. But how about ravens? an unkindness of ravens or owls, a parliament.
Oh, I know that. Parliament of owls. Yes.
Parliament of owls. Yeah. Cool, huh? How about larks?
Don't know larks.
An exaltation of larks.
Exaltation. I can see that as they rise up into the sky.
I think one of my favorites is vultures because they have a couple different names depending on what they're doing. If they're rising up to the air on thermals, they're called a kettle of vultures.
Yeah, I first heard that and thought that seems really odd that they're called a kettle.
Yeah.
And it's called kettling when they do that.
Yeah, fun. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on that. Eagles, a congress or a convocation of eagles.
I like the Congress of Eagles. That's nice.
Congress of Eagles. Yeah. Or how about hummingbirds? Cute little hummingbirds. If you've seen a group of hummingbirds, you've seen a charm of hummingbirds.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. Fun, right? And puffins have to have the best collective noun of all. So the puffin, like we talked about last week, it has some comic appeal. If you've seen a group of puffins, like we saw the other day on the cruise, you've seen a circus of puffins.
A circus of puffins. Yeah, I could see that. To sort of refresh people's memories, we were on this cruise and we went around Smith Island, which is off the west coast of Whidbey. It's sort of halfway between here and Lopez Island. We started spotting them in the kelp beds right off the west coast of the island. What were they doing and why did we see them in the kelp beds?
Yeah, wasn't that a phenomenal sight? It was really beautiful to see that enormous, that expansive kelp bed there. That was one of the main drivers for the state of Washington creating an aquatic reserve around Smith Island and Minor Islands. It's one of the last great kelp forests in Puget Sound. And the kelp forests are just extraordinary ecosystems. They're some of the most diverse and productive ecosystems on the planet. They rival in biodiversity, tropical rainforests. Scientists have found up to 1,000 species in a kelp forest.
The growth rate is
phenomenal.
Astounding.
It is.
Yes.
It's just incredible. It's almost like time. It's more like time lapse photography than actually real time plant like organisms growing. The giant bladder kelp down in Monterey Bay is famous for growing up to 2 feet a day in ideal conditions. 2 feet a day.
Yeah.
It's like you could sit there and watch it grow before your eyes.
We know the kelp beds are really rich. A lot of fish life, a lot of invertebrate life. The tufted puffins and lots of other seabirds were just hanging out on the surface, and they're eating what?
Yeah, so the puffins and their auk cousins, they're mainly eating fish. The mainstay of the tufted puffins' diet is fish, and mainly forage fish, those kind of small silvery fish you think of like herring, sand lance. The ones that we saw, the rhinoceros auklets that had fish in their bills that were close to the boat, it looked like they probably had sand lance, those really thin, narrow fish in their bills. And those forage fish are just incredibly important in the Salish Sea ecosystem. They're kind of right at the center of the food web. They're eating small things like zooplankton, which are eating the phytoplankton. And then above the forage fish are things like salmon, eating the forage fish, and tufted puffins. And they looked like they were feeding pretty well in that bull kelp bed. And that provides a nice sheltered environment for lots of fish, lots of forage fish.
Yeah, and the other thing I was really interested in is that kelp bed was so very close to the bluffs where they were nesting that it was like having the grocery store right outside the front
door. Yeah, pretty good real estate there,
yeah,
right? They've got
yeah.
their cliffside. They had their burrows up there, that beautiful burrowing habitat on that sheer cliff, which makes it inaccessible to land predators. And they've got that nice steep wall up there where they can, to get flying, they can just sort of fall off the edge of their little puffin porch in front of their burrow and take flight. And like you said, they have that amazing kelp forest right there that's just absolutely teeming with myriad creatures for them to eat.
So what part of the year are we likely to see tufted puffins around Port Townsend?
Well, they're here. They come in to breed roughly April through August. Maybe it's a little later. Maybe they'll get here in May. Maybe they'll stay a little later in September. But we could say roughly April through August. And they're here just to breed. That's the only time of year that they spend any time near land. The rest of the year, they're out in the North Pacific, sometimes really far out there, 50 miles, 100 miles. So it would be very, very unusual to see a tufted puffin outside of breeding season.
Which is why that, of course, the puffin cruises that the Marine Science Center and Puget Sound Express do run essentially June to August. So those are the good times here.
Yeah. Right.
I'm curious sort of about the health of the puffins. Are they on either the federal or the state's endangered species list.
Yeah, so they've really haven't been doing very well the past few decades. So they're not listed on federally,
right, yeah,
as on the endangered species list. So the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington did a status report in the year 2015, and they found that the numbers for the puffins were not good. They dropped catastrophically. They were very concerned, and so they decided to list the tufted puffin as endangered in the state of Washington. Right now, the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there's a petition before it to list the tufted puffin as federally threatened or endangered, but that's still under review, and that process can take quite a while.
So where on the Washington coast would you be most likely to see first breeding puffins or puffins out foraging?
Yeah, so tufted puffins used to nest many places in the Salish Sea. They used to be on several islands in the San Juan Islands. Unfortunately, the only last two breeding colonies in the Salish Sea are Protection Island and Smith Island. But if you go toward the outer coast, you know, once you get out toward Nia Bay and Tatoosh Island and places like that, then there are more breeding colonies out there on the coast. There's a big one like down at Ruby Beach. You know, maybe people have been there and looked out toward Destruction Island. So that's there's a big colony out there. But their numbers statewide have just dropped catastrophically, unfortunately. It's thought that their numbers were about 25,000 birds breeding in the state of Washington all through the 20th century. And then just in the last couple decades, their numbers dropped to where they're now estimated at fewer than 3,000. So that's an order of magnitude drop that really caught people's attention. It's pretty concerning.
So before we talk about what may be causing that, do you happen to know, is Alaska or British Columbia or Oregon, are they seeing the same kind of decreases in populations?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it seems that the range of the tufted puffin is really contracting and moving northward. They used to nest as far south as the Channel Islands in California, but that was about a decade ago. They haven't been seen back there since. And, you know, I spent a few years on the Oregon coast before I moved here. Their numbers there, the same as in Washington, they drop catastrophically. A lot of the major breeding colonies that had just teemed with, you know, thousands of birds in the past are gone, or they're just small remnants of what they once were, or maybe there are a few dozen breeding birds, mm-hmm, or something like that. But British Columbia and Alaska, the numbers are still good up there, but there is concern, and there was just a major report published. Some people may have seen that. It made national and international news of a major die-off of tufted puffins in Alaska that scientists attributed to climate change.
That.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the causes, or the likely causes, of this decrease in puffin population.
You know, it's a really complicated puzzle, and I think most scientists most ornithologists who are looking closely at what's happening with the tufted puffin would agree that they can't really point their finger at one specific definitive cause. It's probably a complex of factors.
Okay, first of all, before we talk about those factors, I should ask, what are the ordinary things, like who preys on a tufted puffin?
Oh, yeah, it's a great question.
Ordinary life and death.
So if, just the sort of tufted puffin is natural history, if it were on its own and humans weren't involved in the scene, the tufted puffin would be concerned about aerial predators. It would be concerned about bald eagles. So bald eagles prey pretty heavily, mm-hmm, on puffins. Also peregrine falcons, snowy owls.
So a big bird that can snatch it
That's one of their predators. And then when they're in their nesting colonies, they have a lot of challenges there. If land predators figure out how to get into their burrows and raid their nesting colonies and get the eggs and the pufflings and maybe even the adults, they've got a big problem. And that can be sometimes, you know, just native animals can figure that out naturally, like maybe mink will figure out how to swim out to a remote island or something like that. But there's also invasive species that have been introduced to places where they weren't previously. Rats are a problem. Even rabbits, European rabbits, can get into the burrowing system of the puffins. And of course, they don't prey on the puffins, but they can wreak havoc on the burrows and destroy the breeding habitat. So that's a problem.
Well, and of course, we have seen on Protection Island where if there are deer or other grazing animals, the burrows can be destroyed.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, those deer, which are beautiful to watch, and of course, they're a native species, the Columbia black-tailed deer, but they run around on top of those burrows and put skylights in them.
Life is tough enough with the predators. Let's put humans back in the picture.
we've got a problem with forage fish, Nan. That's probably, I mean, if we had to point to one of the biggest factors, or maybe the biggest factor, their main food source. And as you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, there are a lot of problems, a lot of challenges with forage fish in the Salish Sea and throughout the North Pacific, throughout the world, really. Numbers have diminished dramatically at places like the California coast. You know, there was the collapse of the famous sardine industry there. They're just almost completely gone now. We've had trouble with our herring populations in the Salish Sea, places where they used to breed historically, where they would, you know, they'd spawn in incredible numbers in places like Discovery Bay, and now they're just gone.
Why is that? Why are they gone?
Yeah, well, that is also kind of a complicated complex of factors, and no one knows for sure, but, you know, part of it is forage fish have natural population fluctuations. Part of it is overfishing. They've just been over-harvested. There are definitely concerns with destruction of breeding habitat that they need to reproduce. There's chemical pollution, you know, on and on. Mm-hmm. So kind of a whole complicated, again, a complicated puzzle trying to figure out why the forage fish have disappeared. And then we put climate change into the picture. If we kind of add that piece to it, then the forage fish that still remain that are out there swimming in the Salish Sea, as the temperature of the sea rises, those forage fish tend to move down deeper to cold water. And they may be down deep enough to where the tufted puffin can't dive that deep to get to them, or even if it can dive that deep, it just becomes much more stressful. It
and
hasn't evolved
much
more
to be energy to do that.
Exactly. Yeah, just more energy intensive.
Can dive quite deep.
It can dive deep, but it doesn't necessarily want to. You know, you'll read statistics like they can dive more than 200 feet deep, and that's probably true, but it's like, well, humans can run, you know, 100 miles, but, you know, you and I aren't going to go out and run 100 miles. Average dive for a tufted puffin might hold their breath for about 30 seconds and maybe go down 50 mm-hmm. feet, maybe 100 feet. So if those forage fish are moving down deeper into the cold water as the oceans warm, they're going to be really stressed. They're going to have to go down a lot deeper, work a lot harder, and expend a lot more energy
right,
to get dinner.
To get any food, yeah. I was also thinking, and I'm sure a lot of us have read about the whales that have been autopsied and their stomachs have been seen to be full of plastic. You know, a year or so ago, I had Janine Boer, the executive director of the Marine Science Center, on Nature Now, and we talked a lot about plastic pollution in the oceans. Is there anything known about the impact of the plastics on the puffin?
That's a great question. I wish I knew more about that. I have seen it cited in articles and papers published about the plight of the tufted puffin, but I don't know specifically how much of a role that plays. It's usually kind of down at the end of the list behind other factors. Oil spills are a real problem with the tufted puffin. There was a big spill on the coast. This was before my time, before I was here, in the early 90s, I believe. It was demonstrated that killed 9% of the state's tufted puffin population, the breeding population in the state of Washington. 9% was wiped out just with that one oil spill. And then there's incremental oil that goes in, you know, just minor sort of accidents where a little bit leaks out here and there. So that's a big problem, because their feathers, if they get covered in oil, they lose the waterproof ability of their feathers. And then they get really cold and they end up dying. They just can't tolerate that. They also get entangled in fishing nets. That's a problem, fishing bycatch.
I'm curious now, you said something that kind of made me think. Tufted puffin, like many critters, live in pretty intense situations in terms of cold and their water and land. What are their adaptations that make them successful?
I'm so glad you asked that. It's one of the reasons I love this bird so much. It's not just because it's cute, comical, and charismatic, and because a group of puffins is called a circus of puffins, and because they have babies that are called pufflings, and they have this improbable parrot beak, but they have these extraordinary adaptations that allow them to live in some of the most severe, demanding environments on the planet. They're out there in the North Pacific. How do they stay warm? Well, their feathers have a tight interlocking structure that they maintain with a large preen gland. Most birds have preen glands where they have oil. The tufted puffin has a particularly large one, and they spread that oil on their feathers to maintain that tight interlocking structure. It's so perfectly arrayed, that feather structure, that it's like a perfect little dry suit. It keeps the water away from their body. So they don't have blubber to stay warm. Warm and dry, yeah. Basically, they're dry, and that cold North Pacific water stays away from their body because of that feather structure.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, we have talked through, I think, another program, but I kind of want to ask you one last question. I know your eyes just light up when we talk about tufted puffins. What's your favorite most thing about them?
It's so hard to choose. I think kind of back to that idea that they've evolved to live in a place that just doesn't seem very hospitable to birds. And the fact that they can live out there, they can disappear for 7 months of the year on the North Pacific. And when I love the tufted puffin most, it's not when I see it, Nan. It's not when I'm looking at one from a boat and seeing its orange bill and watching it carry fish. It's when I don't see them. It's winter, the middle of winter, when I go out to the open coast to watch the storms. I love storm watching in winter and those big epic storms that stir up the huge swell and the big waves come crashing in and the sea is tumultuous. And it just looks like one of the most inhospitable places on the planet. And I think about the tufted puffin out there, not just surviving, but thriving. That's where it evolved to live. And it's adapted, perfectly adapted to that environment. But what it hasn't adapted to and what it might not be able to survive is, unfortunately, the changing ocean that humans have had a hand
in. Which is a question we unfortunately have to ask over and over again for many, many ecosystems. Well, Steve, this has been great fun. Again, Steve Grace, a local naturalist right here in Port Townsend. Thanks for coming, and we'll have you back on the show and talk about something else fun.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Well, the puffin cruises are finished for this year, but there will still be opportunities to explore our regional sea and bird life with the folks at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and Puget Sound Express. Watch for the fall migration cruises starting in October. Check the Marine Science Center's website for future cruise announcements. So let's listen to that mystery sound again. Yes, of course, those were the calls of Canada geese in flight, a common sound and sight and sometimes considered a nuisance around the Chinese Gardens Lagoon, Katai Lagoon, and the Port Townsend Golf Course. We've probably all seen the V formation flocks of flying geese, and the folks on the radio show Bird Note described this behavior as a synchronized aerial tailgating. Larger birds, such as geese and pelicans, fly in V formations, but smaller birds do not. Why? Well, each bird behind the leader takes advantage of something called a tip vortex, or an upward spiraling lift off the wingtips of the bird in front. Taking advantage of these efficiencies saves the geese energy. Smaller birds probably just don't create enough of an updraft to help each other in their flocks. Those V formations might also enhance the bird's ability to see each other and to communicate through honks and calls. And my thanks to Bird Note for this brief description. Well, there are a few upcoming things on a natural history calendar here in the Port Townsend area. So with Nora Petrick's help again, what's coming up?
Well, join the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for a low tide walk on Saturday, August 31st. Explore tide pools and learn about how marine organisms are adapted for the challenges of living in the intertidal zone. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Museum Portico entrance for this guided walk on the beach with Marine Science Center naturalists. Recommended apparel are weather-appropriate clothing and shoes with good traction for moving around on the wet, slippery rocks.
Also on Saturday morning, August the 31st, the Admiralty Audubon is offering another of their partial loop walks along the new Chetsumoka or Chetchmahan Trail. Meet at 8:30 a.m. at the Reveille Restaurant at Fort Wardron. The trip leader is Monica Fletcher.
This coming weekend is definitely a beach weekend. On Sunday, September 1st, the Friends of Fort Wardron are hosting a beach walk to learn more about the geology of the shore from events that have happened during our lifetimes to those that occurred as long as 150,000 years ago. Geologist Michael Machette leads the walk that will begin at the North Beach County Park. Participation is limited, so check the website of the Friends of Fort Wardron for registration details.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Many thanks to our steadfast sound crew. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrick. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments. You can email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Thanks for listening. And today's ending music is The Cry of the Wild Goose by Frankie Lane. It was number one on the charts in 1950.
My heart knows what the wild goose knows, and I must go where the wild goose goes. Wild goose, brother goose, which is best, a wandering foot or heart at rest? Tonight I heard the wild goose cry, winging north in the lonely sky. I tried to sleep, but it was no use, 'cause I am a brother to the old wild goose. Was kind and true to me. She thinks she loves me, the more fool she. She's gotta learn that it ain't no use to love the brother of the old wild goose.
My heart knows what the wild goose.